Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway, and this edition is published in the early hours of Wednesday, the 15th of July. Our main stories: former socialite Ghislaine Maxwell is denied bail in the Jeffrey Epstein sex trafficking case in New York. President Trump sets out a litany of complaints against China as he strips Hong Kong of its preferential trade status. And a police chief in Germany resigns over suspected police links to a series of neo-Nazi threats. Also in the podcast:
il faut continuer d'appliquer ces gestes barrières.
I hope that in the coming weeks we'll have made face masks mandatory in all enclosed public places.
More of us are being told to wear face coverings, but how do we stop our glasses steaming up? She was once a leading socialite in New York, but on Tuesday a court in Manhattan told Ghislaine Maxwell that she must stay in jail for at least a year pending her trial on sex trafficking charges and perjury. Ms. Maxwell is accused of luring young girls to be sexually abused by her former boyfriend, the late financier Jeffrey Epstein. She is the daughter of the late media mogul Robert Maxwell and a friend of Prince Andrew. She pleaded not guilty to 6 charges and argued she should get bail because she was at risk of catching COVID-19 in prison. So why did the judge refuse? I spoke to our correspondent Laura Trevelyan in a busy street outside the court.
Well, essentially, the judge agreed with the prosecution argument that Ghislaine Maxwell was a significant flight risk. Prosecution argued that because she's wealthy, because she has multiple passports, she has a French, British, American passports, and the French don't have an extradition treaty with the US, so if she did skip bail, you wouldn't be able to get her back here. And also because of the lengthy jail sentence that she's facing, up to 35 years for these alleged crimes, that she had every incentive to skip bail. And the prosecution also argued that the way she's behaved since Jeffrey Epstein was first indicted suggests that she's been in hiding, she's been using false aliases, she's been buying a property in New Hampshire and pretending she was a journalist seeking privacy. And also, when the FBI turned up to arrest her, she tried to get away from them, and her mobile phone was covered in tin foil, which prosecutors took as evidence that she was trying to evade detection by law enforcement. So for all of these reasons, the judge agreed that she was a significant flight risk.
And the court also heard from some of Epstein's alleged victims.
Yes, and that was very moving. There, 2 victims gave testimony via statement, and then 1 via video link, Annie Farmer. Annie Farmer accused Maxwell of being a sexual predator, of having groomed her for Jeffrey Epstein, and essentially said that she shouldn't be given bail because she was just the kind of person who would skip the country. There was reference from the victims to Maxwell's international connections, you know, this kind of jet-set lifestyle that she had. And of course, for the victims, it's important to remember that because Jeffrey Epstein killed himself in jail almost a year ago, they never got to have their day in court with him or to feel that justice was served. So the idea that Maxwell would try to get out on bail and potentially skip, and then they would once again be deprived the chance of seeing justice being done, was too much for them, and that was the argument that they made to the judge.
So she spends the next year in jail until the trial, and this must be a huge come down for someone used to living a luxury lifestyle.
Well, that's right. Of course, she was the 9th child of Robert Maxwell. His yacht, Lady Ghislaine, was named for her. He was a successful publisher, owner of the Daily Mirror newspaper, but then the lavish lifestyle for her became curtailed when he fell off his yacht, and then it turned out he was accused of defrauding the Mirror pensioners. She came here to New York, started a new life. Jeffrey Epstein liked her social connections, and he had the kind of lifestyle that she'd had before, and so she became sort of a half lover, half friend, half house manager. And prosecutors allege that she procured underage women for Epstein to sexually exploit, and sometimes took part in the exploitation and abuse herself. And the fact that she was a grown woman reassured the young women that somehow this behaviour was all right and they could take part in it. But, you know, her lawyers argued that she absolutely should be allowed bail because she's not in any way a flight risk, that she's not Jeffrey Epstein, but she's being blamed for his crimes unfairly, and that the press coverage is hysterical, and that she could get COVID-19 in jail. All of these reasons, but the judge was unmoved and denied her bail request.
Laura Trevelyan outside court in New York. Tuesday was not a good day for relations between China and the West. First, Britain decided to ban the Chinese tech giant Huawei from any role in its 5G mobile networks. Then just hours later, President Trump signed an executive order to, quote, hold China accountable over the national security law that Beijing has imposed on Hong Kong. At a Rose Garden news conference, Mr. Trump said he was ending the territory's preferential trade status over China's oppressive actions. And he outlined a string of other complaints against the Chinese communist authorities.
No administration has been tougher on China than this administration. We imposed historic tariffs. We stood up to China's intellectual property theft at a level that nobody's ever come close. We confronted untrustworthy Chinese technology and telecom providers. We convinced many countries, and I did this myself for the most part, not to use Huawei. Just today, I believe that UK announced that they're not going to be using it.
Well, the British government's decision to ban Huawei from its 5G was a significant U-turn after the country had previously said the firm could play a limited role. Huawei warned that the decision would push the UK into the digital slow lane. Here's our security correspondent, Gordon Carrera.
This reverse was driven by pressure from Washington, as well as hardening attitudes towards China amid the coronavirus pandemic and events in Hong Kong. The claims that dependence on Huawei could open up a country to espionage or even sabotage, which the company has always rejected, are far from new. But the US played a new card by imposing fresh sanctions in May. These meant that Huawei was left to find replacements for American-built components. The US is now likely to be satisfied. It will use the UK's change of heart to make the case for other countries to follow suit. So far, there's been no response from Beijing. Last week, its ambassador here warned against treating China as an enemy. And a former member of the Chinese Foreign Ministry, Victor Gao, questioned the wisdom of the British government.
Does the United Kingdom really expect they can manhandle a Chinese company, the leader in 5G technology in the whole world, without suffering any consequences? Wake up.
When Australia challenged Beijing over the origins of the coronavirus, it responded with restrictions on trade and its claimed cyber attacks as well. Now the UK will be wondering whether China will choose to take a tough line to discourage others or whether it will play a longer game.
Gordon Carrera. Israel has been on a diplomatic blitz, taking foreign ambassadors to its northern border with Lebanon. It's been warning of what it sees as the ongoing risk from the presence of the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah across the frontier. There are also concerns that tensions with Iran, which backs Hezbollah, could increase the risk of a flare-up. Our Middle East correspondent Tom Bateman reports from northern Israel.
Are these steps here?
Steps are original.
They're original, are they?
Yeah, steps are original.
A descent deep beneath Israel's northern frontier. Air is pumped in. Moisture drips from the rock.
You can see this piece here. This, I think it's about 20 centimetre diameter, is actually the drill head.
The tunnel was dug from Lebanon by Hezbollah, drilling about a metre a day, says the IDF's spokesman, Jonathan Conricus. The Israeli military wanted to show me the tunnel, one of six they exposed 18 months ago. He says they would have been used for a raid into Israel to kill or abduct soldiers or civilians.
It definitely is a huge and long endeavour. Taking away the tunnels from Hezbollah is nothing short of strategic. Hezbollah, if they'd had this operational tool, they would have been able to use it at their discretion, at Iranian timing and orders, and we could have found ourselves in a third Lebanon war.
Israel's been drawing fresh attention to the tunnels, recently giving tours to Western ambassadors. It complains that the UN peacekeeping force along the border, UNIFIL, is prevented from fully monitoring Hezbollah. The two sides last fought a war in 2006, and rhetoric is always heated. Amid Lebanon's economic crisis, Hezbollah chief Hassan Nasrallah appeared on TV last week. He warned of dangerous consequences for the region over Israel's recent plans to annex Palestinian territories. Hezbollah is dominant in Lebanon. backed by Iran, seen by much of the West as a terrorist group. It's viewed by its supporters as a resistance force against Israel. It benefits from tensions on the border, says Lina Khatib from the think tank Chatham House. But she says for now, an all-out conflict is not in its interests.
In the past, Lebanon's problems were largely security-based, such as the Israeli occupation when it happened up to 2000. And Hezbollah would come and say, we are the solution. But now Hezbollah is left to fight this other challenge, which is economic deterioration, which it is not well equipped to do.
But a flare-up can start well beyond this border. Part of the strategic battle between Israel and Iran is fought in Syria. This was an Israeli airstrike last August outside Damascus to stop an Iranian armed drone attack, said Israel. It killed two Hezbollah operatives. The group later fired anti-tank missiles across the Lebanon-Israel border, narrowly missing Israeli troops. Israel tries to roll back the influence of Iran, which uses Syria to transfer weapons to Hezbollah. Randa Slim of the Middle East Institute in Washington says the group's program to develop precision-guided missiles is in Israel's sights.
At some point, they have to get to the senior leadership in that program, either Iranian or Lebanese. Then it's going to be too costly for Hezbollah not to respond, reputation-wise.
Do you think that's inevitable then, that kind of development?
I think the course that the two parties are on right now, I think it is inevitably a collision course.
Back on the border with Lebanon, Israeli defences are being fortified. Hezbollah is the landlord of the other side, say the Israelis. But Lebanon's government frequently complains about Israel's breaches of the UN peacekeeping resolution 1701.
And what about Israeli overflights of Lebanon using Lebanese airspace as a launching site for attacks inside Syria? As far as UNIFIL's view, the UN's view, that shouldn't be happening.
What we've said in response to that is that Hezbollah violates 1701 on a daily, hourly and secondary basis. As such, the only step that we can take is to monitor using various means, one of them being the aerial reconnaissance.
The UN is due to review the peacekeeping mandate next month. Both countries will watch closely, like they do here, at one of the region's most combustible borders.
And that was Tom Bateman in northern Israel. Still to come in the podcast, our correspondent reports from Russia's Far East on a rare challenge to President Putin's authority. Ethiopia's Grand Renaissance Dam on the Blue Nile is the largest hydroelectric project in Africa, with the capacity to double the nation's electricity output and even benefit Sudan and Egypt to the north. The problem is, both those countries rely on the Nile for their fresh water, and they are deeply concerned about what will happen when the dam is being filled by Ethiopia. The latest round of negotiations between the three nations ended on Monday with no agreement. But Ethiopia is planning to start filling the dam anyway. Catherine Bayaru-Hanga has this report.
For millennia, the River Nile has sustained civilizations through fishing and farming. But its power has the potential to modernize a nation and lift its people out of poverty. This is crucial for Ethiopia, source of 85% of the river's water. It's building a mega dam as long as New York's Brooklyn Bridge and straddling two mountains. It will be Africa's biggest hydroelectric power station.
We prepare everything using firewood. We cook food with firewood. Sometimes we use coal or gas. We have to go to the forest to look for the firewood. It's very tiresome.
80 kilometers north of the capital, Addis Ababa, 42-year-old Jafari Gilma is hoping the electricity the dam generates will make for a better, healthier life. About 60% of the country's population doesn't have access to power.
If we get electricity, we'll be able to use a cooking and baking stove, and we'll be clean, we'll have better lives. We are now covered with ash. We are getting poisoned from smoke. We are wrapped in smoke.
But the $5 billion Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam is also a deeply personal project for many Ethiopians. The government raised the money by encouraging citizens at home and in the diaspora to buy up bonds and make donations. Jafari's husband also contributed and even visited the construction site 3 years ago. Downstream in Egypt, the foreign minister has said Ethiopia's dam poses an existential threat for the country. It relies on the river for 90% of its freshwater needs. Farmers and fishermen like Wakbi Said Amin are worried about low water levels in the future.
Our life and our livelihood depends on the Nile. We, as a family, live by the river. We fish, we grow crops on the islands in the Nile, our cattle are fed from the Nile, all our food is from the Nile.
For 9 years now, Egypt, Ethiopia and Sudan, the other country that could be affected by the new mega dam, have been negotiating on how it will be operated. Reaching an agreement has proved difficult. Mediation efforts by the United States failed earlier this year, and now the baton has been passed to the African Union.
I'm heartened by the fact that they continue to talk and no one has completely walked away from the table.
Daniel Stoll is Associate Dean for Global Affairs at St. Norbert College in Wisconsin.
The two major sticking points remain what happens during periods of drought, and also can there be some kind of dispute resolution mechanism? And that's where the three countries are still at loggerheads.
That report by Catherine Bayaru-Hanga. The police chief in the German state of Hesse, Udo Munch, has resigned over suspected police links to a series of neo-Nazi threats. A police computer was accessed to obtain the personal information of those targeted. Damien McGuinness reports.
At least three prominent German women have been receiving neo-Nazi threats sent using data accessed on a police computer. A left-wing politician, a German-Turkish comedian, and a lawyer who represents victims of far-right violence have all been targeted. Other politicians have also been sent similar threats. It's not clear who accessed the police database, but officials say they're not ruling out the existence of a far-right network within the police force.
Damien McGuinness. In a rare challenge to President Putin, thousands of people have been taking part in protests over the arrest of a leader in Russia's Far East. Sergei Fergal was elected governor of Khabarovsk 2 years ago, beating an ally of President Putin. His supporters say his arrest over murders which took place 15 years ago is politically motivated and have taken to the streets for 4 days in a row. Our correspondent Steve Rosenberg is there.
I'm walking through the centre of Khabarovsk, being drowned out by car horns that are beeping in support of protesters who are walking through the city. They've come out risking arrest to criticise the authorities in Moscow and to voice their support for the regional governor, their governor, who was arrested last week, flown to Moscow and accused of links to multiple murders dating back a decade and a half. And that has sparked a lot of anger here in Khabarovsk, where many people believe that the move against their governor is politically motivated. This man, Sergei Fergal, is not from Vladimir Putin's team. His popularity locally has been going up, while President Putin's popularity here has been going down. Now, on Saturday, there was a big protest. Around 30,000 people came out. The protest today is much smaller, but there does appear to be a momentum here. And judging from the car horns, quite a bit of support for the protesters and a lot of resentment towards Moscow.
Steve Rosenberg in Russia's Far East. In Belarus, two of President Alexander Lukashenko's main rivals have been told they can't take part in upcoming elections. Sarah Rainsford reports.
After over a quarter of a century as president, Alexander Lukashenko has no intention of losing power in Belarus. Now, two key opponents have been formally barred from running in next month's election. Viktor Babariko's candidacy was rejected after a letter to the Electoral Commission described him as the head of an organised crime group. His arrest last month on suspicion of money laundering brought angry crowds onto the streets in protest, and this latest move could well have the same effect. A former ambassador to the United States, Valery Tsepkalo, was also rejected, supposedly for not having enough valid signatures of support. Mr. Lukashenko's own campaign manager said the president would run on a platform of security and sovereignty for Belarus. But the recent protests have revealed deepening discontent with his authoritarian rule, his refusal to take COVID-19 seriously, and the poor state of the country's economy. Some of the less well-known opposition candidates who have been registered for the election say they'll now discuss joining forces to try to unite the protest vote. Both candidates who've been barred plan to appeal against that ruling.
Sarah Rainsford. More and more of us are being encouraged to wear face masks to reduce the spread of COVID-19, with France and England the latest to adopt the practice. The French President Emmanuel Macron says he wants face coverings to be mandatory in all enclosed public spaces from the 1st of August.
We must continue to apply these barrier gestures. And on this, we see some weaknesses. So I have asked for us to pass a measure in government, and I hope that in the coming weeks we'll have made face masks mandatory in all enclosed public places.
In England, shoppers will be fined if they don't cover their faces from later this month. It all means many more people struggling to work out how to stop their glasses from steaming up. Jonathan Savage has been looking at the problem. So first of all, why do our specs fog up when we're wearing a mask?
Well, of course, you're wearing a mask and, Oliver, you need to breathe. As you will be aware, it's less comfortable breathing in a mask because the air isn't going straight out. It's struggling to escape, and often the most convenient gaps are up the way at either side of your nose. So the warm air goes straight up, it collides with the relatively cold lenses on your glasses, and the water vapour turns back into liquids. That's the condensation. I think you yourself have found it worse on cold days, Oliver, and obviously the colder your glasses are, the more that effect takes place.
Okay, so try it in the summer. It might not be so bad, but is there a way to stop it?
Yeah, one thing you can do is look for masks that are more sculpted around the nose. I've actually heard suggestions that using the nose pads on your glasses to pin down the top of the mask can work too. Some people have said they wanted to tape their mask down, but be very careful what kind of tape you use. Don't use, for example, household masking tape or anything that might damage your skin when you try to take it off. But the solution with the most credence I've seen in my search actually comes from the medical journal Annals of the Royal College of Surgeons of England, who of course wear masks in their job. It recommended wetting your lenses, rubbing some soap on them, then rinsing in warm water before drying with a soft towel. Now that should leave a soapy film on your lenses, which reduces the surface tension. That means the water molecules from your breath distribute more easily, evenly, and they don't cluster in this cloud of condensation. And I don't know if it lasts all day or if it just lasts for a few hours, but it might be worth a shot. There are some tutorials online. Now obviously, misting is irritating, and hopefully we can find and share a genuine cure, because if you're constantly wiping your glasses, your hands are going up to your face much more often than they should be when you're out and about at the moment, with the advice being don't touch your face if you can help it.
Jonathan Savage. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.
Hi, I'm Kim Chakaneta, and I'm the host of The Comb, a BBC World Service podcast.
The Comb, no.
The Comb.
Now, The Comb covers Africa. Obviously, Africa is a very big place.
Omar, you've been looking into this, right?
Yes, I have been. And honestly, Kim, it has been a big eye-opener.
But what we really want to tease out are some of the more universal themes that you find across Africa.
Do you take the well-paying job that you hate, or do you take the job where your passion lies?
As well as the themes and stories that are specific to certain countries.
You should see me in the public transport, tears streaming down my eyes.
And when you bring those two things together, the universal and the specific, you end up finding something quite unique that I think would appeal to listeners, not only in Africa, but around the world.
I still had that sense of pride to say I've made it.
That's The Comb, C-O-M-B, from the BBC World Service. Just search for The Comb wherever you get your podcasts.